From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Smoke and guns and vouchers, faith-based initiatives and civil rights. Today, an assessment of Attorney General John Ashcroft's record with some of Ashcroft's chief critics and one of his admirers, the prominent anti-feminist conservative Phyllis Schlafly. But first, we begin with a Delta flight attendant who won $400,000. She was fired after taking a faulty drug test. In surveillance from the inside out, we'll look at Big Brother monitoring the streets of Tampa, Florida. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The Bush administration told world leaders yesterday it could not support any international agreement that interferes with illegal weapons trade or the right to own guns. The announcement on the first day of a UN conference on stopping the deadly illegal trade of light weapons enraged humanitarian groups and delighted gun rights advocates. The administration also said the United States, the largest supplier of arms worldwide, would not support moves to outlaw any arming of rebel groups, or would it help fund a campaign by human rights groups to raise awareness of the trade. Israeli wrecking crews protected by hundreds of riot police officers destroyed 14 homes at the edge of a Palestinian refugee camp in East Jerusalem in the biggest demolition campaign in the city's Arab neighborhoods in recent years. Distraught families scuffled with police officers, and some people threw themselves on the ground in a futile attempt to block the wrecking crews. Five Palestinians were reportedly hurt, and several were arrested. The homeowners served with demolition orders on Sunday had no chance to appeal. The Jamaican Army has been granted police powers to help authorities curb violence that's claimed at least 20 lives in the capital over the past 2 days. The announcement of the intensified policing operation comes after the country's cabinet met to discuss the situation, which has deeply shaken the Caribbean island. The measure follows clashes between security forces and residents of a poor neighborhood of the capital with strong ties to the opposition. Colombian troops headed to a northern township today where local officials say rightist paramilitaries killed at least 10 villagers last week and forced as many as 6,000 people from their homes. Details are only now emerging of last Wednesday's attack on Peque in a remote area of the northwest, but it could be one of the largest paramilitary massacres in months. In another case, the Colombian Attorney General's office on Friday opened an official inquiry into whether a rear admiral and seven lower-ranking officials were derelict in their duties for failing to prevent a paramilitary massacre of 27 people in the northern town of Chengue in January. And a television reporter was shot and killed in a bar in the Pacific port of Buenaventura, the fourth journalist assassinated in the past 2 weeks in Colombia. On Friday, gunmen killed the news director of the Voice of the Jungle radio. On July 4th, a gunman fatally shot a radio station director in the city of Fresno, and the director of a community radio show in Tolima was killed June 26th. This news from the Ukraine: the director of the private television and radio company Tor, who sought to expose corruption and organized crime, died after he was attacked in his office today by four men with clubs. He's the second prominent newsman killed in a year. And from Chile, demonstrators protested a decision to spare General Augusto Pinochet from standing trial on human rights charges, calling it an injustice to the thousands killed by his military. Yesterday, a divided court in Santiago ruled against putting the 85-year-old general on trial, citing his deteriorating health and mental condition. And this news from New York: according to a new study, more than a third of the U.S. workforce with access to the Internet have their email messages and web surfing regularly monitored by their employers. The study was conducted by the Workplace Surveillance Project of the Privacy Foundation, a research group based at the University of Denver. The Privacy Foundation study estimates 14 million employees are under continuous surveillance using commercially available software.
It's coming from the sorrow in the street, the holy places where the races meet, from the homicidal bitchin' that goes down in every kitchen to determine who will serve and who will eat. It's coming to America first, the cradle of the best and of the worst. It's here they got the range and the machinery of change, and it's here they got the spiritual thirst. It's here the family's broken, and it's here the lonely say that the heart has got to open in a fundamental way. Democracy is coming to the USA. I'm sentimental, if you know what I mean. I love the country, but I can't stand the scene. And I'm neither left or right. I'm just staying home tonight, getting lost in that hopeless little screen. And I'm stubborn as those garbage bags that time cannot decay. I'm junk, but I'm still holding up this little wild bouquet. Democracy is coming to the USA. Sail on, sail on, O mighty ship of state, to the shores of need, past the reefs of greed, through the squalls of hate. Sail on, sail on, sail on.
A Democracy Now! Favorite, Democracy by Leonard Cohen from the United States of Poetry, here on Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. This weekend, a jury in Portland, Oregon, awarded a flight attendant $400,000 from a drug testing laboratory that incorrectly determined she'd cheated on a drug test. The flight attendant, Yusuko Ishikawa, was fired by Delta Airlines in 1999 after a routine drug test showed her urine sample had been tampered with. Yusuko said she never took drugs and had not altered the sample. The jury agreed and found the drug testing laboratory, Lab 1, of Lenexa, Kansas, had been negligent. Yusuko has her job back, but Delta Airlines refuses to admit that it did anything wrong, leading her to wonder who will be the next person forced to battle one of the world's largest airlines over faulty drug testing. We're going to talk about that case in a minute, and then we're going to go to Tampa, Florida. The Tampa Police Department last week installed 36 surveillance cameras with face recognition software in the city's downtown area. Now, everyone visiting the city's downtown will have their faces matched against a police database of people with criminal records and criminal suspects. The software, called FaceIt, is similar to the technology used during last year's Super Bowl when police aimed surveillance cameras at people entering the stadium. This prospect of permanent police surveillance of a major public space has created some unusual allies. These were the words of one prominent conservative politician after hearing about the police department's plans. They said, placing police officers in a remote control booth to watch the every move of honest citizens isn't going to make us safer. This is a full-scale surveillance system. Do we really want a society where one cannot walk down the street without Big Brother tracking our every move? Now, Tampa has taken the next step, and there's nowhere to turn for those who value their privacy. That was, believe it or not, House Majority Leader Dick Armey of Texas. Well, in a few minutes, the ACLU and other civil liberties advocates have been joined by Dick Armey and Representative Bob Barr of Georgia and an anti-gun control lobbying group, the Law Enforcement Alliance of America. And we're going to talk about the Tampa City Council holding hearings on the issue on July 19th. But first, we're joined by Yusuko Ishikawa, the flight attendant with Delta Airlines from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello, good morning.
It's good to have you with us. Can you tell us your story? When were you first asked to take a drug test?
September 1999, I took the random drug test right after I came back from Japan trip. And I was told I was substituted my sample. And I didn't have any appeal, nothing. They terminated me.
And what did they find? What did the drug test find?
They said my sample was diluted and appeared to be substituted. And according to their word, this is equal to refusal to the test. So right away, I was suspended without pay and benefit and pending termination.
Go ahead.
Yeah, at that point, I asked them to do anything to prove my innocence. I would love to do anything to prove my innocence. For example, like my hair sample, blood test, and they refused it because, according to them, Delta's lab is 100% accurate. There's no mistake. So,
and just to clarify, they're not even saying they found drugs in your urine. They're saying that the test was diluted and they felt somehow you had diluted it.
That's correct.
Why was the urine diluted?
As a flight attendant, we were told to drink a lot of water because of the airplane is very, very dry. And I would keep drinking a lot of water. And I would like to add this. When I took the drug test, toilet water was dye blue, and they took my urine temperature right away, and my urine temperature was normal. So I was reported as everything was okay. And
is it true that a Delta medical review officer called you at home?
Yes, and he told me that my test result was something wrong. He said my urine was diluted. At that point, he introduced himself as a doctor, but I was talking on the phone with this totally stranger, and how could I know he's a doctor or not? And I felt very uncomfortable talking about my urine over the phone. So I reported to my supervisor right away. Is that really the regular way to call somebody, ask about urine?
And right. You mean the man just called you up out of the blue and started asking you about your urine?
Yes. And then he said, he used dilute, the word dilute, and English is my second language. I couldn't understand what the dilute mean. And I asked him, what is dilute? And he said, my urine is too thin for human urine. That's the word he used. It. And at that point, I truly believe that he is a pervert. Because since I never used drug in my life, there is no reason why this guy is asking me about urine. So that was very weird.
So what did you say to him?
What did I tell to him?
Yeah, once you had thought he was just a pervert.
I was just trying to be polite and quiet, and I just told him that I drink a lot of water, so if it happened to be dilute, too thin for human urine, maybe I was drinking too much water. And I didn't really have any doubt about my drug testing result.
Right. So
yeah.
So they fired you, Delta.
Exactly. They fired me without any appeal. They treated me very shamefully. And my base manager and supervisor told me that I have a perfect spotless record of 7 years with Delta Airlines. But this test result is always 100% accurate. So they even sent Delta's lawyer, regional manager, and doctor to explain whole base that Delta's lab is 100% accurate. At that point, my coworkers starting to make a lot of noise, and they stood up for the justice. I got a lot of support who are risking their job.
What did the other flight attendants do?
they started to wear yellow ribbon to protest my mother, and some flight attendants started to make thousands of flyers in the anti-Delta system to explain what is going on, because I was in a Portland base, and Delta has 20,000 flight attendants. So for them, I was just a little number. And doesn't matter I was honest person, honest, hard-working person or not, it's just a little number. At that point, I realized that if somebody who is a single or single mothers, how could they survive all of a sudden losing their job with this accusation? How can they find a next job?
So you had all of these flight attendants wearing yellow ribbons, plastering airport bathrooms with flyers in your defense, and the flight attendants Delta aren't union?
We're the only one major airline doesn't have a union in the flight attendant.
So they were seriously risking their jobs.
They are. I was extremely worried about my ex-co-workers at that point. They were really risking their own job to save me. I sincerely appreciate those people.
But you ultimately were reinstated. Why?
Because Delta's pilot has a union, and they found a lot of mistake in this lab, and
in the Lenox account, the lab one of
lab
Lenox
one, Kansas. Yes, and there is one pilot who was fired same reason as me, before I was terminated, and then because of the Pilot Association, he got reinstated, and he got also pilot license back. So Delta, right after they rehired him, announced that they are going to hire him back, they announced that five other flight attendants will be reinstated, which is including me. Obviously, in the 1 year before me, there is four other flight attendants were terminated by same issue.
So you were returned to your job, but you sued anyway.
Well, I've been suing from the beginning because I knew something is wrong. And at the same time, management is starting to spreading the rumors about me. It was just devastated.
What were they saying?
I admitted my guilt, and I was using animal urine. Delta was giving me the other test, and I fell again. All of those are lies, and I was just devastated. And at the same time, I knew something is wrong, and these huge corporations are walking all over little person like me. It's not right. And I felt like I have to fight for justice. And I have to really fight for other people too. Because as I told you, there's a lot of people, if they lose their job, they don't have a place to live. And after I knowing those wonderful support, they really made me stronger and stronger. I'm just a regular person. For me to win against a huge corporation like this is an ant kill an elephant. I sincerely appreciate American justice system, and I'm very proud of my fellow co-workers who risked their job to stood up for justice.
Well, Yasuko Ishikawa, I want to thank you for being with us. Again, this Delta flight attendant just won $400,000 from a Portland, Oregon jury suing Delta for...
Actually, this is a judge dismissed for some reason for Delta's case, but I won against Lab One.
so that you ultimately won your case against the lab that did the test.
So which proved that I wasn't the one made a mistake. They're the one made a mistake.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. When we come back from our break, we're going to go from surveillance from the inside out, and we're going to look at video cameras on the streets of Ybor City and Tampa, Florida. Yasuko Ishikawa, thank you for joining us.
Thank you very much.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. The Tampa Police Department last week installed 36 surveillance cameras with face recognition software in the city's downtown area. Now, everyone visiting the city's downtown, Ybor City, will have their faces matched against a police database of people with criminal records and criminal suspects. The software called FaceIt is similar to the technology used during last year's Super Bowl when police aimed surveillance cameras at people entering the stadium, putting through hundreds of thousands of facial images to a central computer system. The prospect of permanent police surveillance of a major public space has created some unusual allies. As I read before, the quote of none other than House Majority Leader Dick Armey saying, "Placing police officers in a remote control booth to watch the every move of honest citizens isn't going to make us safer. This is a full-scale surveillance system. Do we really want a society where one cannot walk down the street without Big Brother tracking our every move?" You've got people like Dick Armey allying with the ACLU. And we're joined right now by Darlene Williams, who is a member of the board of directors of the Tampa chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union. Can you tell us about the response to these video cameras in Ybor City?
Good morning, Amy. Yes, really, the cameras themselves, there have been video surveillance cameras in Ybor City since 1997. But the problem is that now they have installed this FaceIt technology, which, as you said, for the crime of walking down the street in Ybor City, you will now be placed in a police lineup without, you know, without any rights to deny it or without, you know, any suspicion at all. You're going to be placed in a police lineup. And the response has been rather interesting. As you stated, we have garnered some rather interesting allies in this battle, including Congressman Armey and Congressman Bob Barr of Georgia. And, you know, anyone who values freedom, really, is very concerned about this issue. And certainly the ACLU is on the forefront of this issue, as we have been on so many issues concerning the freedom of Americans throughout the years.
How did this happen?
Well, you know, Amy, that is probably the question of the day. As you well know, this same technology, not the same system, but the same technology was employed during the Super Bowl. And what many people don't know is that it was also in place in Ybor City during the Super Bowl for a solid week. And none of us really knew about that until now. Apparently, on May the 10th, the city council voted to implement the software. The problem is they were under the impression, or so they say, that they believed they were implementing just a simple upgrade to the existing cameras. They did not understand that they were essentially submitting their citizenry to a police lineup.
So the snooper bowl has become permanent.
The snooper bowl has indeed become permanent. And the most, one of the most interesting things about it is one of the councilmen in an Associated Press article was quoted right after the Super Bowl incident that were this technology to become more permanent in nature, he would favor public hearings. Well, it's been implemented. There's been no public hearings. The ACLU has consistently been making public information records requests. We have not received, to date, any documentation. We don't know what database is being employed. We don't know how they're doing this. We don't know what they're doing with the images afterwards. They're telling us what they're doing, but we have no documentation, so apparently we are all supposed to trust them.
Now, just understand, the same company that's using this face recognition software is also doing it for welfare recipient ID cards?
That is my understanding. There are, this technology is being employed in some states for that kind of thing. The technology, the data of these faces, because they look at apparently approximately 80 points around the eyes and nose area, and using an algorithmic function, they come up with a certain formula, and then they place you in this lineup. It's my understanding that information can be reduced to an 84-byte piece of data and embedded in a chip on the smart card technology, which is then utilized to verify, you know, identification of the recipient.
How does racial profiling fit into this picture?
Well, actually, Amy, we raised that concern. And here again, we're going to have to, until they give us the public information that we have repeatedly asked for, apparently we're supposed to trust them, because the manufacturer alleges that the computer is the one that decides which 4 to 6 faces out of the crowd it is going to run against the database, and that, in fact, the human operator only comes into play after the computer says, I found a match. But, there again, we have no documentation, and the concern and the potential for racial profiling and freedom of association issues is a very, very large concern that the ACLU has in this circumstance.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us. Tomorrow, we're going to look at what's happening in Colorado, where the Department of Motor Vehicles is buying cameras that will map every driver's facial characteristics like a three-dimensional land chart, and it will compare with video cameras on the highways those pictures to driver's license. They'll be putting in everyone's driver's licenses into a central computer. Have you heard about this?
I haven't, but that is the same technology, because this does indeed do a three-dimensional representation of the face. And the interesting thing is, Amy, is not only do we have unusual allies, but unless the cameras can turn 360 degrees, and if they go beyond the 35-degree angle, they're extremely inaccurate. And interestingly enough, according to a study that was done by San Jose State University Biometric Test Center, in 43% of the time when subjects were placed, pictures were taken 18 months apart, 43% of the time the computer had false negatives. So in other words, 43% of the time they failed to identify the same person with photographs taken 18 months apart. It's my understanding that even the Army has rejected this technology because of the fact that it cannot consistently identify real positives.
Well,
it's really not a good system.
I want to thank you very much for being with us, Darlene Williams, member of the Board of Directors of Tampa Chapter of the Florida Affiliate. I also want to thank the listener who sent me a wig to wear around at the station here at WBAI, which now has 7 surveillance cameras up with another one planned. Everywhere we walk now in the station, we are being watched. So today I brought in my New Orleans special, which is a wonderful feather mask, and each day I have another mask to, well, express concern about that kind of video surveillance. Tomorrow we'll look at Denver and the Department of Motor Vehicles and the cameras that will be placed on Colorado highways.
America provided the atmosphere for the blues, and the blues was born. The blues was born on the American wilderness. The blues was born on the beaches where the slave ships docked. Born on the slave man's auction block. The blues was born and carried on the howling wind. The blues grew up a slave. The blues grew up as property. The blues grew up in Nat Turner visions. The blues grew up in Harriet Tubman courage. The blues grew up in small town deprivation. The blues grew up in big city isolation. The blues grew up in the nightmares of the white man. The blues grew up in the blues singing of Bessie and Billy and Ma. The blues grew up in Satchmo's horn, on Duke's piano, in Langston's poetry, on Robeson's baritone. The point is that the blues is grown. The blues is grown now, full grown, and you can trace the evolution of the blues on a parallel line with the evolution of this country. From Plymouth Rock to Acid Rock, from 13 states to Watergate, the blues is grown, but not the home. The blues is grown, but the country has not.
From the mind of Gil Scott Heron, a collection of poetry and music. You are listening to Democracy Now! The Bush administration told world leaders yesterday it could not support any international agreement that interferes with the legal weapons trade or the right to own guns. It also said that the U.S., the largest supplier of arms worldwide, would not support moves to outlaw any arming of rebel groups, nor would it help fund a campaign by human rights groups to raise awareness of the trade. The announcement came on the first day of a U.N. conference aimed at stopping the deadly illegal trade of light weapons, and it enraged humanitarian groups and delighted gun rights advocates. Tomorrow, we'll talk to several participants at the U.N. conference about the U.S. role in blocking progress on halting the illegal small arms trade. But today, we're going to look at the record of the Justice Department under the leadership of Attorney General John Ashcroft, starting with the issue of guns. Attorney General John Ashcroft was President Bush's most controversial administration nominee. In 1999, then-Senator John Ashcroft of Missouri led the effort to defeat African-American State Supreme Court Justice Ronnie White's nomination to the federal bench. The year before, he praised the Confederate leaders who fought to preserve slavery in the Southern Partisan, a neo-Confederate national journal. He's killed measures which would improve voting access, and he's opposed to abortion, even in cases of incest, rape, and when the life of the mother is threatened. Given this record, many were worried about what Ashcroft would do for women and African Americans as Attorney General, but his two most controversial moves have been on gun control and tobacco. Last week, the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence filed an ethics complaint against Ashcroft, asserting he'd violated his ethical obligations to his client, the United States, by sending a letter to the National Rifle Association. In the May 17th letter, Ashcroft wrote, quote, "Let me state unequivocally my view that the text and the original intent of the Second Amendment clearly protect the right of individuals to keep and bear firearms. While some have argued that the Second Amendment guarantees only a collective right to the states to maintain militias, I believe the amendment's plain meaning and original intent prove otherwise," unquote. That, again, in a letter from John Ashcroft to the National Rifle Association. The Brady Center contends the letter sabotaged an important Justice Department case on gun control, which hinges on the interpretation of the Second Amendment. We're joined right now by two people, Michael Barnes, president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, and renowned conservative leader Phyllis Schlafly, founder and president of the Eagle Forum, who made her name in the movement to defeat the Equal Rights Amendment. And we welcome you both to Democracy Now! Michael Barnes, can you lay out your objections to this letter that Ashcroft wrote to the NRA?
Well, thank you. When Attorney General Ashcroft was being considered by the Senate for confirmation, you'll recall that he promised that this is the kind of thing he would not do, that he would not permit his personal views to affect his actions as Attorney General, but rather he would simply enforce the law. We sought, when he sent this letter to the National Rifle Association, we sought the opinion of Sam Dash, probably the most respected legal ethics expert in the United States. He was Ken Starr's legal ethics expert during the Starr investigation of President Clinton, and he was involved in Watergate, and he's professor at Georgetown University. And Professor Dash gave us an opinion letter saying that Attorney General Ashcroft's action in sending this letter to a party to litigation in which the United States is also a party, directly countering the position of his client, the United States of America, was, in Professor Dash's word, an egregious violation of legal ethics. I'm a lawyer, and I think any lawyer listening to this would recognize that, no attorney sends a letter to another party in pending litigation saying, I disagree with my client's view on the an issue in this litigation, and I agree with your position. This was an outrageous action by Attorney General Ashcroft. We were joined by Common Cause, President Scott Harshbarger, the former Attorney General of Massachusetts, and I together filed the complaint with the Ethics Office at the Justice Department, also with the Bar Association Ethics Office, and with the White House Counsel Office, asking for an investigation of this action, really a very blatant violation of fundamental legal ethics by the Attorney General of the United States.
Phyllis Schlafly, your response to the Ashcroft letter to the NRA as president and founder of the Eagle Forum.
Well, Michael's whole argument is based on false assumptions. Ashcroft did not promise to follow the dictates of the Clinton administration. He promised to follow the Constitution. And the position in the case that is pending is not the position of the U.S. government. It's the position of the Clinton administration. And it is Ashcroft's view, and the view, I think, of the majority of Americans, that it's just simply contrary to the Second Amendment. Michael and his friends just simply have problems with the Second Amendment. And it is certainly proper for Ashcroft to advise us what really the Second Amendment means. And it does protect the right of individuals to keep and bear firearms. And that's the issue in that case. And it was the Clinton administration that tried to change the law, not Ashcroft.
Michael Barnes.
Well, actually, this has been settled law for decades. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously in 1938 that the Second Amendment is a collective right, not an individual right. They said that was the obvious. That's the Supreme Court's word, not mine. The obvious intent of the Founding Fathers when they adopted the Second Amendment. But that's not the issue here. You know, we could fight all day over what the Second Amendment means. That's not the issue. The issue is that an Attorney General of the United States had, in pending litigation, sends a letter to an opposing party saying that my client's position, my client being the United States of America, my client's position in this litigation is wrong.
Michael Barnes, can you explain the litigation, the lawsuit?
Yeah, it's a case that was brought in Texas against a man by the name of Emerson. Under federal law, it is illegal for people who are under restraining orders in domestic cases to own firearms. And the allegation is that Mr. Emerson threatened his wife and a child with firearms. The wife went to the police. He was arrested and charged with violating this federal law. And the United States government, through the Justice Department, has been defending the law, and Emerson's lawyer has been arguing that the law is unconstitutional, that he has a right to these guns, and under the Constitution of the United States, and the United States has been arguing that he doesn't have a constitutional right to these guns. And the National Rifle Association joined as a party in this case, and as an amicus party, and argued in favor of Mr. Emerson's position. In the middle of this comes the Attorney General of the United States and sends a letter to the opposing party saying, you know, you're right. You're right on the law. This is exactly the kind of thing that he promised the Senate that he wouldn't do. And you'll remember that a number of senators said, well, I'm going to vote for Ashcroft because I know the man. I know him to be a man of integrity. And he has promised us that all he's going to do is enforce the law. He's not going to impose his own personal views. He's not going to reflect his own personal views, and because of that, I'm going to vote for him. If he had told the United States Senate, if he told the Judiciary Committee that he would send a letter to the National Rifle Association in this context, he would not have been confirmed as Attorney General, and I'm sure that Ms. Schlafly would agree with me.
No, absolutely. I think everything you're saying is false. He never said those things. He said he was going to enforce the law, and it is his job to tell us what the Constitution says. And the issue in the Emerson case is whether Dr. Emerson had the right to own a gun. And your problem is with the Second Amendment. And Ashcroft was right and proper for him to make a public statement saying what the Second Amendment means.
Before
it has not been settled law that it doesn't mean that. In fact, the majority of of all the commentary about this subject for many years has been that it is an individual right. The evidence is overwhelming that it's an individual right.
Every appellate court in the United States in this century has ever, actually, every appellate court in the United States has ruled the same way that the Justice Department has had this position under Republican and Democratic administration.
Before we move on to another aspect of Attorney General John Ashcroft's record, I just wanted to ask you, Michael Barnes, president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence, about Ashcroft aligning himself with the NRA, moving to have the FBI begin destroying government records on millions of gun purchases almost immediately after the weapons are sold. What is this about?
Well, this is a travesty. Tragic when in a country where we're losing 80 people a day to gun violence, 80 people a day on average dying from gun violence, to have the Attorney General of the United States helping the criminals. And that's what this does. The destruction of the records makes it more difficult for law enforcement, for the FBI and others, to find criminals and arrest them and put them away as they should be. As the Los Angeles Times said in an editorial a couple of days ago, the National Rifle Association sure is getting its money's worth out of this administration. You know, they bragged during the campaign that if Governor Bush were elected, that they'd be working right out of his office in the White House. Well, they may not have an office in the White House, but they clearly have one in the Justice Department. The only group in the United States pushing for the destruction of these records is the National Rifle Association, and they've clearly become the criminals' lobby in this instance. This is very sad to see these records, which the FBI has said need to be maintained for at least 90 days, and now the Attorney General of the United States says, well, we're only going to keep them for one day. This is very sad in a country where we have a tragic epidemic of gun violence, 80 people a day dying and hundreds of people every day being wounded by guns.
Well, we're going to
Michael is completely misrepresenting the law, because we're not talking about a list of criminals. We're talking about a list of law-abiding people. And the promise was made, and it's in the law, that they will not keep a registry of lawful gun owners. This is what we're talking about. And we do not want the government having a registry of lawful gun owners. When you do your instant check, they can keep it for a few weeks, but then they should not keep that list, because we don't want the government having that registry. And that's exactly the sort of thing that the United Nations is trying to do in its meeting this week. They're trying to establish national and then global gun registries, and their purpose is confiscation. That is what they're after.
Well, we're going to break for stations to identify themselves. I want to thank Michael Barnes for being with us, president of the Brady Center to Prevent Gun Violence. We asked Phyllis Schlafly to stay on the line with us, president, founder of the Eagle Forum. We're going to move on to the issue of tobacco litigation and the latest moves of the new Attorney General. And then we're going to take a look at faith-based initiatives and vouchers. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman. As we continue a look at Attorney General John Ashcroft's record, we just looked at the Justice Department's role in a major gun control case, but critics say he's also severely undermined the Justice Department's case against large tobacco companies. Under former President Clinton, the Justice Department sued Big Tobacco because smoking costs the federal system $20 billion a year in health costs. But a few weeks ago, Ashcroft asked the Justice Department to see if it could settle the case out of court. At the same time, justice officials said publicly they were worried about ultimately losing the suit. Analysts say that this was the equivalent of waving a white flag before a charge. We're joined right now by Bill Corr, Executive Vice President of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids, and we still have with us on the line Phyllis Schlafly, President and Founder of the Eagle Forum. Bill Corr, can you talk about John Ashcroft's record on tobacco right now?
Good morning, Amy. His record on tobacco actually goes back to his days as a senator, and it's instructive as to how he views the role of government with this issue. As a senator, he was one of very few members who opposed Senator John McCain's effort to create a comprehensive tobacco prevention and control effort in this country, including excise taxes, including well-funded prevention programs to try to reach kids and get them not to start and help adults stop. As Attorney General, and that's the key thing now, he has, in our view, significantly mishandled this lawsuit. But in looking at what he has done, it's very important to remember what this lawsuit is about. It's not just about suing an industry and trying to collect some money. Tobacco kills 400,000 Americans, and we have, as we speak, a pediatric epidemic where 90% of new regular smokers are less than 19 years old. One-third of high school seniors smoke. The tobacco industry for 40 years has been marketing without accurately telling the American people what how addictive the products are, and they continue to market to children. This lawsuit is most important because it gives the Justice Department the opportunity, if they prove their case in court, to require the industry to stop their marketing practices that have so much influence on children. And that's what we are most concerned about in Attorney General Ashcroft's actions, that he has failed to provide an adequate budget for the lawsuit to go forward. He has allowed anonymous leaks from senior officials in the department that undermine the case. He's authorized settlement discussions at a point in the case when they are quite premature. The Justice Department lawyers have not had a chance to look at the industry's internal documents that would allow them to establish that this illegal behavior has continued. And prior to seeing those documents, it is not wise to seek settlement discussions. We are not opposed to a settlement at some stage, but it is premature now, and time after time his actions have served to undercut this lawsuit rather than allow it to go forward in court where it belongs.
Phyllis Schlafly, your response.
Of course the case should be settled. Tobacco is a legal industry, and for those who think it should not be legal, your remedy is to go into Congress, to the legislature, and get it made illegal like marijuana. It should not be made illegal by Clinton pandering to the trial lawyers who make a lot of money out of the settlement along the way. The government has no business trying to litigate the industry out of existence. It's just simply legal. It's always been legal. And if you want it to be illegal, go to Congress and try to make it illegal. The whole lawsuit was part of Clinton's payoff to the trial lawyers, and I think the money that the lawyers have gotten out of tobacco already is just unconscionable. I don't know why somebody isn't filing suits against the attorneys general who've made these private deals with their pals to get this these large sums of money in these anti-tobacco lawsuits. I think it's just an outrage and a perversion of our system.
Amy, may I respond to that?
Bill Corr, yes.
The Department of Justice's lawsuit does not allege that smoking is illegal or that tobacco should be made illegal. It doesn't ask for that remedy at all.
I didn't say that.
It alleges that the tobacco industry for 50 years has intentionally and willfully deceived the American people and misled them about the harmful nature of tobacco, about the addictive nature of nicotine. The Department of Justice is asking for fundamental reform in the tobacco industry's marketing practices and in the claims they make that mislead adults who smoke. This is not about making tobacco illegal. It is about stopping illegal behavior by the tobacco companies. And just for the record, trial lawyers have no role in this lawsuit. This is being handled by Department of Justice lawyers and not by private trial attorneys.
Well, that's one thing the Department of Justice shouldn't be doing. Everybody has known for 50 years. I've known for 50 years since Evitz Graham at Washington University made these did this research 50 years ago. And if people want to engage in risky behavior, that's one of the things you can do in our free country. There are all kinds of people who engage in risky behavior that I don't approve of. But I'm not trying to get the government to try to hound them out of existence by imposing enormous costs and litigation on them. I just think the government should back out.
Before we move on to our last issue to deal with the new Attorney General, Congressman Tom Udall of Colorado is asking Bush to take the Attorney General off the team negotiating the settlement to the government's lawsuit against tobacco companies, arguing that Ashcroft's public opposition to the suit has tainted the process. What's your take on that, Bill Corr?
Congressman Udall has suggested to the President that he appoint a bipartisan group of state attorneys generals who can act as neutral arbiters in this case. It is one constructive suggestion that would allow the court to proceed with this case and allow for settlement. We are not opposed to settlement of this case. We are opposed to the Department of Justice giving it away early in the litigation before the Department of Justice knows whether it can establish all the facts that it alleges about the tobacco company's continuing behavior. So we applaud Congressman Udall's interest in this case. We hope that the President and the Attorney General will understand that there are serious misgivings in the country about the way in which they're handling this litigation, and politics and campaign contributions and the effect of all that has no place in this litigation. It should go forward in court with settlement, if that's the appropriate conclusion of the case at an appropriate time. And we applaud Congressman Udall for his concern.
Well, Bill Corr, I want to thank you for being with us, Executive Vice President of the Campaign for Tobacco-Free Kids. As we move on to our last couple of issues that we're dealing with around John Ashcroft, Phyllis Schlafly will stay with us, President and founder of the Eagle Forum. People for the American Way was on the one of the staunchest opponents of Ashcroft's nomination. We're joined now by Elliot Mintzberg, who is the legal director of People for the American Way, to talk about the role of the Attorney General and the Justice Department in the debate over President Bush's faith-based initiatives, school vouchers, and civil and voting rights. Elliot Mintzberg, as you look at we're more than 100 days into John Ashcroft's term as Attorney General, but what is your major assessment now?
Well, it is still a little bit early. It has been less than 6 months, but we've seen a number of troubling signs from the Attorney General and from the administration on the issues that you've mentioned. In particular, just this morning, for example, in the Washington Post, there was a front-page story about a secret memo of the Salvation Army talking about a deal worked out between the Salvation Army and the administration that if the Salvation Army supports the administration's so-called faith-based initiative plan to provide more funding directly to religious organizations, that the administration agreed in return that it would enact a regulation that would protect the Salvation Army and other organizations or exempt them from having to comply with state and local laws that ban discrimination based on sexual orientation. So if this deal went through, in which we would assume the Justice Department and Mr. Ashcroft would be very involved, since Mr. Ashcroft is one of the so-called fathers of the charitable choice concept, that would mean that organizations like that would get an automatic exemption from anti-discrimination laws at the state and local level that apply to everybody else, and that's extremely troubling. We've also seen, just in the first few months, Mr. Ashcroft's Solicitor General, Ted Olson, take a very unusual step. He filed a brief with the Supreme Court just the other day in a case in which the federal government doesn't have any direct interest asking the Supreme Court to take a case out of Ohio to overrule a decision and to declare that school vouchers are perfectly constitutional, a very aggressive action by the Solicitor General in a case in which the federal government really didn't play any role at all. And the third thing that probably bothers us the most is the failure to act by the Justice Department under Mr. Ashcroft. We've seen increasing reports since November of very serious problems in last November's election when it comes to deprivation of voting rights. The Federal Election Commission has reported recently that many states are not complying with the motor voter law that requires people to be able to register to vote at driver's license bureaus by not processing those forms in time for people to be able to vote, for example. We ourselves are involved in a lawsuit in Florida on behalf of a class of African-American citizens in Florida that were deprived of their voting rights because of problems that occurred at the polls. Unfortunately, the Justice Department has been missing in action in all of those areas and hasn't taken action in those critical issues relating to civil rights and voting rights.
Phyllis Schlafly of the Eagle Forum, is this a concern of yours?
Well, you've raised a number of issues. In regard to the faith-based rules, that will be decided by Congress. It will not be decided by Ashcroft, and we'll wait and see what happens. There are a lot of problems with that. But on Ashcroft not following through on some things, I would agree with that in general. The first and most important thing that he's failed to do is to fire all of Clinton's 90 U.S. attorneys all over the country. They're all in existence. The day Clinton went into office, he fired every one of the U.S. attorneys and put his own people in. Ashcroft has failed to replace the Clinton attorneys, and I think he ought to act immediately on that. On voting rights, yes, there are things he ought to do on voting rights. In my own county, there were 13,000 people who voted who were not registered. And I think the voting of people who are not qualified to vote by aliens, by unregistered people, by felons, is something that he ought to go into, and I'm urging immediate action on that. Your vote doesn't count for anything if somebody else is going to be able to stuff the ballot box with illegal votes. And I think it's very important that they do that. And, of course, all of these areas where, or at least most of these areas where these frauds took place are areas that are totally controlled by the Democrats.
Let me just say a couple things about what Phyllis has just said. First of all, on the issue of Congress and the faith-based initiatives, it is true that there is a legislative proposal in front of Congress now that relates to that. But what's really disturbing about this story in the Washington Post this morning is that the plan was, and I hope was, hopefully this publicity will put an end to it, but the plan was to go around the legislation, to not put this provision in the legislation itself, but to have the administration, through OMB, through the Justice Department, et cetera, issue this rule that would exempt these organizations from state and local anti-discrimination laws. And
well,
that's particularly troubling.
Don't blame it on Ashcroft. Troubling. He didn't write it.
No, it is certainly true. We have not seen the memo yet. We don't know Ashcroft's direct involvement. We do know that Ashcroft has been very involved in the whole faith-based initiatives initiative. And I would frankly be surprised if something was talked about that rose to level, particularly one relating to federal regulations where the Attorney General has a plenary role, if he didn't have some involvement in it. But the second point with respect to voting rights is particularly interesting. The one instance
we have 10 seconds.
The one instance relating to voting rights where Ashcroft was involved was a claim like the one that Ms. Schlafly mentioned. But there's been no involvement at all with respect to the many minority citizens who were deprived of their right to vote.
I'm
and that's where we'd like to see.
Who allowed to vote who that's were not where qualified to vote.
That's where we'd like to see action by the Attorney General that we have
not seen. We would like
to
see action on the minorities who were allowed to vote who were not registered.
Well, on that note, I want to thank you both for being with us. We'll continue certainly to follow that last issue on voting rights in this country. Elliot Mintzberg of the People for the American Way and Phyllis Schlafly, president and founder of the Eagle Forum. That does it for today's program. Democracy Now! Produced by Chris Abrams and Brad Simpson, Anthony Sloan, our engineer from the embattled studios of WBAI, the studios of the Band and the Fire, the studios of your listeners. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening.
Sail on. Sail on.